Good morning. Welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft, is at the controls. In this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking about the issue of sex equality in the context of sports. And we have two guests, Eileen McDonough and Laura Papineau. And they are the authors of a newly published book that we'll be talking about. And the title of their book is Why Separate is Not Equal in Sports. Oh, that's the subtitle, I should say. The title of the book is Playing with the Boys. The subtitle is Why Separate is Not Equal in Sports. The book is published by the Oxford University Press. In the book, they make the argument that while it is certainly true that women have made great strides since the passage of Title IX in 1972, that law never demanded and, in fact, never accomplished true gender equality. In the book, they argue that sex differences do not justify women's exclusion from competing with men. They also say that the fact that there are different rules for women in sports reinforces the view that women as a group are inferior, relegating them to second-class status in American life. Our guests, Eileen McDonough, she is professor of political science at Northeastern University, and Laura Papineau is a journalist. She has won a number of awards for her work. Her work has appeared in the New York Times and the Boston Globe magazine, Good Housekeeping, the Washington Post. Currently, she is writer-in-residence at the Wellesley Centers for Women at Wellesley College, and they're both joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions, comments are certainly welcome. I expect we certainly will have some people who will want to comment and get in on the subject, and that's certainly fine. The only thing that we ask of people who are listening is that when they call in, they try to be as brief as they can so that we can keep the program moving along and get in as many different callers as possible. But certainly, the questions and comments are welcome. If you're in Champaign, Urbana, where we are, 333-9455 is the number to call. We do also have a toll-free line. That means if it would be a long-distance call for you, whether you're listening on the air or whether you're listening on the internet in the United States, that number will work for you. That's 800-222-9455. At any point here, you want to give us a call, you certainly can do that. Professor McDonough, hello.
Yes, hello.
And Ms. Papineau.
Hey, how are you?
Good, thanks. And thanks to both of you for talking with us. We certainly appreciate it. Oh,
thank you for having us.
I guess I would want to begin. I'm assuming that to begin, you both of you would say that you think that Title IX has been a good thing for women and their participation in sports.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So the fact that it opened up all kinds of possibility for young women, women at various ages to play sports, that's a good thing. However, and we can talk about this and try and get into some detail, your essential argument is that the idea that that sports are continue to be sex segregated, and that even women who would want to participate on teams with men or with boys, the fact that they can't is a problem.
Yes, I think that's the key. It's not that it's just a custom or tradition. There are legal prohibitions in place that prevent women from even the opportunity, even when they're completely qualified to play on boys' or men's teams, from doing so. And so what we oppose is coercive sex segregation that's legally enforced.
Uh-huh. So you would not have a problem with it if someone wanted to have a team that was, well, I'm not sure. I guess what I was going for is the idea that if you voluntarily, if everybody was okay with everybody to mm-hmm. have single-sex teams, you'd say that's fine.
Well, I think if you look at the law, what the law affirms in court cases that we've examined is that when a group that's historically been excluded and therefore a subordinate group in relation to another group, which is generally women in relation to men or blacks in relation to whites, for example, courts have allowed the subordinate group to voluntarily exclude itself and voluntarily segregate itself, but has not allowed the dominant group to do that because they already have an advantage and they have often been doing that already.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes. Same-sex women's teams on a voluntary basis, courts have affirmed as a constitutional option, but prohibiting women from playing on men's teams when women are qualified has been constitutionally viewed as not permissible by courts.
And I think the key here also is that that what we're arguing is that we have a situation right now in which sex is the first line of division when we look at how sports are organized rather than the last, mm-hmm. meaning we look first at one's gender when we're dividing up teams before we look at someone's skill level, their experience, and so on. So unlike, you know, sports is the most sex-segregated secular institution in our society. It's more sex-segregated than the military. And what we're arguing is that by making gender the kind of front line divider in athletics, whether we're talking, you know, NCAA Division I basketball, which may be one story, or we're talking kindergarten soccer, or, you know, 45-year-old tennis leagues, what we're saying is that by creating a structure in which gender is the kind of first dividing line, that it informs other areas of gender equality in our society.
Mm-hmm. So you're that and also what I'm sure we'll talk about, the fact that in men's and women's sports there are different rules for competition. There are, you know, people do things like they swim different distances, or professional tennis players, the men play longer matches than the women, or in golf the men and the women hit from different tees. Mm-hmm. That all of that, you're also making the argument that it has a message that may be subtle or not so subtle, that in fact men and women are simply not equal, that women are in a physical way are not the equals of men.
Well, that is the assumption. The assumption behind sex segregated policies, whether they are that women don't have to play as long in order to complete a game or whatever the rules are, all of these rules are based on the false assumption, we feel, that women as a group, all women as in the group, are inferior to men, and that assumption is simply false. So the rules, our premise of our book is that sex-segregated policies in sports do not reflect physical differences between men and women as much as these rules construct physical differences by restricting views of sports to only those cases where the assumption is women are inferior to men, and that's why women are segregated, and that's why they play by different rules, and so forth.
I mean, what we found in looking at, you know, in our research is that there are so many instances where there are different rules for men and women, and the rules have absolutely no relation to the actual physical differences between men and women.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, for example, we know that women are physiologically particularly capable in ultra-distance and endurance events. We know that, and yet in 1996, when they laid out the course for the first ever off-road bicycling, they lay out the course the night before, and the course it was created so that the top female finisher would finish in 2 hours. And they laid out the men's course that the top male finisher would finish in 2 hours and 15 minutes. And that is simply not about actual physical capabilities of men and women. That is about differentiating and creating the male race as the standard and the female race as the other.
And I guess I suppose it's not something that I had particularly thought about, but there are certainly sports in which men and women compete essentially in separate leagues or separate associations or whatever, that the sports are not integrated, where it seems that this sort of idea that men are stronger, so the rules should be different, they still compete separately in things where physical strength, you'd think, it has nothing, almost nothing to do with your success or your ability to play, like bridge, or like billiards, or like bowling, or where, you know, stuff like, yeah, I suppose one might make, you know, professional football is one thing, but billiards is something where it shouldn't make any difference
at
all.
Well, that's right. And also, for example, chess, you know, chess are sex segregated. And that is an example of how deep the legal sex segregation is in competitions that are games or sports between men and women, where clearly, let's just say men do have, as a group, you know, greater upper body strength than do women, but that upper body strength does not have anything to do with how you play a card game or billiards, for example. And so the sex segregation of sports, where clearly there is no physical correlate that would map onto gender difference, yet there's still sex segregation, is what we're talking about and drawing attention to, the almost invisibility but flawed use of gender as a marker for women's inferiority compared to men, when in fact that's not the case at all.
I'm curious, if say within the world of chess, how do they, if you go to them and you say, now really, this really doesn't make any sense to have the boys and the girls compete separately, does it? How do they respond? Why do they say that that they still do that?
Well, those are the rules at certain levels of competition. Certainly, I mean, I've been involved in kindergarten and grade school chess tournaments where, you know, it is a co-ed environment, but those are particular rules for particular international tournaments. But what is interesting is, you know, like in chess and some of these games, women are kind of, there's a little asterisk next to them, and they're treated as a protected group, similar to, you know, the elderly or juniors.
That's correct. And this is, of course, extremely ironic when you think about it, because in the game of chess, the queen is the most powerful piece on the board. So to assume that women need protection when, in fact, you know, the piece on the board that is the most has the most flexibility in terms of how to play the game is a gendered piece is somewhat ironic, but it's certainly not unusual to find, even in, you know, card games or board games, sex segregation or this idea that women need to be protected as a group. They need to be protected from injury when either physical or psychological, I assume, when playing, if they were to play with men. That's why they need to be separated.
Let me introduce again very quickly for anybody who might just have tuned in, our two guests, Eileen McDonough and Laura Papineau. Eileen McDonough is professor of political science at Northeastern University. Laura Papineau is a journalist. She's currently writer-in-residence at the Wellesley Centers for Women in Wellesley College, and they are the co-authors of the book Playing with the Boys, Why Separate is Not Equal in Sports, published by the Oxford University Press, in which they make this argument, as I mentioned at the beginning, that in spite of the fact, and we would have to acknowledge that Title IX has been good for women, giving women and girls the increased opportunity to play sports, they make the argument that because there continues to be sex segregation in sports, that continues to reinforce the view that women as a group are inferior to men. Questions, comments, welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And I suppose in one respect that people are going to say, well, we're really talking about sports here. Does this really matter that women might be, aside from the fact that you might generalize to the rest of life, or maybe that is the key here, that I guess we have to acknowledge the fact that that sports are important. They're important in the public consciousness, and it does, you know, it does indeed shape the way that you see the world. So maybe indeed it is an important thing.
Well, I think that is a major concern that we had, which is why we wrote the book, is that sports matters whether an individual directly is involved in sports or cares about sports or not. Sports as an arena, figuratively and literally, in our society matters enormously, not only in terms of the imagery that it's portraying to huge publics, greater numbers of people than almost any other type of activity gets to, but also because it is so structured on a premise of women's inferiority, it is communicating to people, however unconsciously the message might be received, that women are second class when it comes to ability to compete with men. And that translates into more than just the ability to play a particular sport. It translates into a view of women's lack of equality with men that we feel has sort of after effects on every area of American society, most importantly politics, for example.
And I think you know, the other piece is that, you know, sports has in essence almost been given a free pass. It's been treated as entertainment, as, you know, a pastime, as something to do when you're not, you know, dealing with political or work or other arenas. And yet, you know, the very truth is that, you know, that the images, the relationships that are created in sports about the gender hierarchy, about men's roles and women's roles, are translated and enforced and have an effect. I mean, women are 51% of the population and 15% of Congress. Last time I checked, there are 8 female CEOs in the Fortune 500. There is a relationship between power and image in sports and in the rest of life. And if you look at the comparable abilities of female athletes and male athletes, even in their own arenas, I mean, women athletes today are incredibly impressive and powerful, and yet you look at the you know, differences in pay, status, exposure, and it is way out of proportion.
Yeah, I think that I'm sure that that's an important point, that we would you could pick male and female athletes who are at the top of their game, whatever the game are and it is, and who are very highly paid. But I feel fairly confident that you know, the difference between the highest paid player in the men's professional basketball and women's professional basketball, or say, you know, take Tiger Woods, who must be the richest guy in professional golf, and pick out whoever is the richest woman, and that we could go through just about everything. And one thing that I'm confident of is that there would be a very significant gulf between what the top paid male athlete makes and what the top paid woman athlete makes.
For example, we know that in the women's golf, that there is about to be the first $1 million purse. And, you know, and there's much excitement. There was a kind of humorous USA Today story, I think yesterday, about, you know, how would the prospective winners spend that money? Well, the truth is, in men's golf, you know, purses are 3, 4, 5 times that routinely. It is just not even close.
Mm-hmm. Can you, I suppose some people would say that, you know, professional sports is a money-making enterprise, and that many more people are willing to pay money to watch men play than women play, so that the prize money has to be commensurate with the potential for the league or the team or whatever to make money, and there's an economic reality here that has to do with potential audience and potential money making, and that's one of the reasons that Tiger Woods makes so much money. And I really must apologize to people who follow professional golf. I couldn't tell you who
Annika Sorenstam, maybe.
Okay, Annika Sorenstam. Right. So the fact that he makes so much money, Tiger makes so much money, more money than Annika does, has to do with, you know, willingness of people to pay money to see him and her.
Well, I think one of the important things when it comes to that very issue is that for years people justified women getting much less at Wimbledon because they weren't making the ratings. Mm-hmm. Well, then when women's ratings outperformed male tennis ratings there was Wimbledon where women were higher, then the argument was that, well, they're only playing 2 out of 3 sets and men are playing 3 out of 5. Well, finally last year, you know, the pay was equal. But what is so striking is that, you know, there are 2 points I want to make. The first point is that there is a relationship between public interest and exposure for these sports and the willingness of people to pay dollars for them. I mean, when, you know, who would think that golf would be interesting on television? Potentially. I mean, you're watching a ball rolling towards a hole, and yet the drama, the time given to developing the stories and the dramas and the, you know, the meetings of players and the competition, which is the narrative that the TV producers, you know, create, you know, helps feed that demand for interest in those sports. And, you know, research has, you know, been done that you know, shows that, you know, the time given to developing male characters in sports is just way, way out of proportion
right.
to female sports.
The other thing to keep in mind is that if you start from the assumption that women are inferior to men, and that's why they're in separate leagues, and that's why they aren't playing as many sets, let's say, in tennis as the men do or whatever, you're starting off with that assumption, then why would you expect people to be as interested or to pay as much to watch a team that, by definition, is supposed to be inferior? It's a sort of self-fulfilling prophecy, it seems to me. And as far as professional sports go, one of the things we recommend is ways that women can become integrated into professional sports in ways other than actually being, let's say, on the NFL football team. For example, there is no reason why women could not be referees for the Super Bowl, even if they're not on a team itself. The referees that are chosen for the Super Bowl are not necessarily at all former football players. They're people that have just been referees other places and have accumulated a good record in terms of being a good referee, and then they are part of a pool that is chosen at to be from which is chosen the Super Bowl referees. And these are men who are lawyers. They can be in fire departments. They can be in all walks of life. They're not former professional football players necessarily. There's no reason why a woman couldn't be a referee in the Super Bowl. And the image of seeing a woman as a referee in authority over the male football players, we feel, would be a way of integrating for the public the view that women are participating in a sport, even a professional sport, even if they aren't actually on the team. And we think this would be very beneficial for the public to see that.
Hmm. Well, now, just out of curiosity, I wonder, have there been women who have come forward and gone to the union or association or who, you know, what the club, whoever it is,
right.
the professional referees, uh-huh. and said, hey, you guys, I'm perfectly capable of doing this. I want to be a referee in football.
But there's Violet Palmer, who's an NBA referee, but she's the only one.
There's only one woman referee in the NBA.
In the NBA, right.
Yeah.
Well, what we want to emphasize here is that we are barely at the point right now in American society where women are tolerated as being integrated with men in terms of traditional teams or even or any teams for that matter. It's just, if we look at the law cases where women have had to go to court to play football in high school with the boys or to wrestle with the boys in junior high or high school, they certainly weren't even tolerated. They were actually prohibited. They went to court, they won, and now they're tolerated on these teams. What we want to see and what is in the future is not just toleration, but celebration and encouragement. We aren't to the point yet where it's even been an issue, where sex segregation has even been an issue. So where the mold is broken, there's toleration, but there isn't yet proactive encouragement to encourage girls and women to do this, to play with the boys, much less celebration. And that's what we need if we're going to get women referees in the Super Bowl.
Hmm. What can you say? I realize this requires something of a vast generalization, but what can you say about how accepting boys have been of girls who want to play on their teams? I mean, how exactly has that worked out?
I think it's very different. I'm a parent of three kids who've played youth soccer, and I can tell you that when I went on Monday to register my son for, you know, the spring season, I encountered a big black box with a in red ink. It says note, and I'll just read the first line of this. It says, "If you are attempting to register a daughter, please be aware that Newton Youth Soccer is co-ed, but primarily boys."
Hmm.
So that this is a co-ed league in a very open-minded community. And when you go to register, that's what we're confronted with. What we're saying is that, yes, you know, by all measure, you know, Newton Youth Soccer, you know, is co-ed, and, you know, they love girls. But how does one feel when one goes and encounters this when you're about to register?
I think there's a range, as there always is whenever any social adjustment is made between groups where there has been separation in the past. I think you find some boys are comfortable and some boys aren't. And mostly it's the parents, I think, that also have a lot to do with this. And
well, I guess one example of that mm-hmm. is in Alaska last year. A girl named Michaela Hutchinson won the Alaska State Wrestling title. And to give her opponent, Aaron Boss, credit, he said, "I don't look at it as a loss to a girl. I look at it as a loss to a wrestler."
Right. And then on the other hand, there are examples of girls who have wrestled with boys, and when they've lost, the boy has broken down and started to cry and just dropped out of wrestling. Now, the question here is, the presumption is that this same boy would not have done so if he'd lost to a boy. And so it raises the question, let's put it this way, it is, again, a vicious circle. If girls are assumed to be so inferior that if you lose to a girl, it means that you're even more inferior than a girl, then, of course, it poses tremendous problems for boys who are put in a situation of competing with girls. But that is, of course, what needs to be broken, is that vicious circle. Girls aren't inherently all inferior to boys. So if you lose as a boy to a girl, you just lost to a wrestler, not to a girl.
And I think the other point that we, you know, really want to emphasize in the book is that this is not like the girls against the boys. This is really meant, you know, as a way of looking at gender and seeking gender equality for both sexes. I mean, there are a lot of boys who are not super athletes, and they go through a lot of pressure because they're not, you know, high-performing athletes, a lot of social pressure. And we're saying that, you know, that's just as inappropriate as a girl who is a super athlete who, you know, is barred from playing on a you know, otherwise all-male team. So it's really about letting sports be, in a sense, a political tool for gender equality.
Right.
Well, we have a caller to bring into the conversation. I want to do that and also tell people who are listening that we are now just a little bit past the midway here in this hour of focus, and I would like to introduce again our guest, Eileen McDonough and Laura Papineau. Eileen McDonough is professor of political science at Northeastern University. Laura Papineau is an award-winning journalist, and currently she is writer-in-residence at the Wellesley Centers for Women at Wellesley College, and they are the co-authors of the book Playing with the Boys. The subtitle is Why Separate is Not Equal in Sports, and it's published by the Oxford University Press. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. And we have a caller here to talk with in Champaign, line number one. Hello.
Yes, I'm a little bit confused by this because we're talking sports, and I would think I heard Tiger Woods' name mentioned as the premier men's golfer, and I would imagine I could mention Michael Jordan at the time he played as the premier male professional basketball player, and maybe Barry Bonds, notwithstanding he's now under indictment, as the premier home run hitter of all times in Major League Baseball. And I'm saying I'm using these icons and these sports to ask you, what do you mean when you say that in your thesis that women are not inherently inferior to men? Well, I just named these three guys, and I probably could name Roger Federer in men's tennis, and I'm at a loss to see how any woman could not be considered inherently inferior, at least physically or physiologically, when asked to go up against these iconic men athletes.
Okay, well, let's start from the first point, which is that we don't know what would happen if women competed with the top male athletes, because they don't. We have examples in the past, for example, of a woman pitcher striking out Babe Ruth. And what happened to her when she did this is that she was basically fired from her team, and then the Baseball Commission put in a rule that women couldn't be pitchers and compete against men. We have another example of a woman who, in fencing, won all of the tournaments in competition with men. When she competed directly with the top men and won, then the International Fencing Commission put in a rule that women can't compete anymore with men and retroactively took away her international license. Now, we just don't know what would happen. We've never seen it. You're just assuming that these male athletes, who are, of course, brilliant, would never lose to a woman, but we don't know. It's never happened. The other point is that even if it were true that the best woman would not beat the best man, it is simply not true that all men who are good will beat all women who are good. Take, for example, the Boston Marathon, which is a very physical event. It's impossible to even discern from the newspaper reporting where the best woman stands in relation to the best man. All that's ever reported is that the best man is faster than the best woman. But if you look at exactly where the best woman places, one year, for example, recently, the best woman was 17th in the race. That meant that it means that every single man who ran after her was slower than she was. So, yes, she wasn't as fast as the best man, but she was a lot faster than most of the men, and that's what we need to see.
And I think another example in the running is Paula Radcliffe, who just won the New York City Marathon. Back in 2003, she won the London, in the London Marathon, she broke a world record with 2:15.25 as a finishing time. And what was interesting, for that entire year of 2003, none of her countrymen, not one British male runner, ran faster than she did. The New York Manhattan Island Marathon swim has been won. 2002 is won by Emily Watts, who beat beat everyone, including a men's relay team. So, you know, Michael Jordan may be iconic, Barry Bonds may be iconic, and there may be sports in which, you know, the top male outperforms the top female, but we can also come up with examples in basketball. I mean, think of Candace Parker. When she was in high school, she won the McDonald's dunk contest over her male contenders. So there are different, there are different settings in which males do not match female performance. Plus, there's so much overlap between male and female performance that to use a super athlete like Michael Jordan, or on the other side to use Paula Radcliffe to proclaim that males or females as a class are inferior is not fair.
Okay, well, thank you.
All right, thank you. Let's go to another caller here. This is Urbana, and it's line number 2. Hello.
Hi. I just had a happy story about fencing. In the fencing club in downtown Champaign, I don't know anything about fencing at a college or professional level, but at the club in downtown Champaign, the boys and the girls and the men and the women all fence together. There's no difference. The girls are welcomed and treated like everybody else, and it's a really great atmosphere. And I just wanted to say that it's a long struggle for women athletes, but in that little situation, they really are getting the benefit of being able to compete, to play with the boys and enjoy it and
that's
be welcomed
wonderful.
And celebrated. And it's a really, I just wanted to add
that's
that.
Wonderful.
No, that's absolutely terrific.
That's
what we need more opportunities for that, because it, as you probably know or see or can observe, it goes far beyond just, the fencing arena.
And it's just as good for the boys to play with the girls as it is for the girls to play with the boys.
That's absolutely.
Right. Absolutely. Yes. A really great thing. Anyway,
right.
Thanks for
thanks.
Really great discussion.
Thank
great.
You.
Bye-bye.
Other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Something else you mentioned in the book, and I guess I hadn't really thought about this as an interesting kind of additional wrinkle to this, is that there are some sports, the sports that are integrated, have one thing in common, and that is they involve a third party,
mm-hmm.
in the sense that auto racing is not segregated. There are men and women jockeys who run side by side, equestrian sports. So if there's a car, a boat, an airplane, or a horse involved, we seem to be more accepting of the idea that that men and women can compete with.
Even though these are extremely physical sports, which includes also dog sled racing, which is extremely physical, right? So if sex segregation were to reflect physical differences, then these sports should be sex segregated. Equestrian sports are extremely demanding physically, as well as dog sled racing and others, and yet they aren't. And we contend the reason is because if men lose to women in a third-party sport, the man can always say the woman had the better horse or the better dog sled team or the better airplane or whatever the third entity is. And it's sort of an out that is possible, which is not possible when men and women directly compete without that third entity.
I'm sure that there are people who would be willing to grant that in almost any sport, and maybe any sport, we could find men and women who were in all respects equivalent. They were equivalent in their size and in their muscle mass and in their reaction time and in their endurance and in their ability to play the game. But that overall, there is still this concern that on average, men are bigger than women. And if we have boys and girls playing together, particularly in sports where there is some contact involved, that the girls are going to be injured at a greater rate than the boys. Is there anything to that kind of concern?
Well, go ahead.
Go ahead, Eileen.
Okay, well, who's going to say, well, first of all, the assumption that being bigger is always an advantage is, of course, incorrect. For example, in car racing, being bigger is not an advantage. It's a liability. Also, being a jockey, it's a liability to be tall and heavier than rather than short and light. So
let's just be careful that we all that we don't take the male standard as the one that is always preferable. It's not. There are advantages to women as a group that privilege them in some sports over men as a group. But then the idea of being injured, courts have said that if a school system, for example, wants to protect its players, let's say on a football team, from injury, it has to protect the boys as well as the girls. It isn't going to be the case that you can't just say, we're not going to let girls play because they might get injured. Boys can get injured on football teams as well. And so there's no grounds for not protecting boys from injury if you're going to protect girls from injury as some sort of policy. And so the, first of all, assumption that every girl will be smaller on a football team than every boy is probably false to begin with. And second of all, to single out just the girls for protection and not the boys is unconstitutional, according to court cases. And so if we're concerned about injury, we have to be concerned about it for both boys and girls, men and women, not just one sex.
And I think the other key here is that the this whole argument and language around injury and concern for injury and the protective stance towards females is has a long history, and it's exactly the history of discrimination. If we look at why women were barred from higher education, it is because there was concern that the blood from their blood needed for all that heavy thinking in the college would be drawn from their uterus and to their brain, making them barren, so that women need to be, quote-unquote, protected from higher education and the rigors of it. Likewise, I mean, one of the things we did was we looked at old, pamphlets from Modess, and the messages that girls got about, playing sports during, their periods was, just don't, that you can't, that you're too frail. And after a while, when these messages are repeated, the society doesn't need to enforce them, but women enforce them upon themselves. They internalize them, and the same thing with the protections against for women in workplace. The original rules, barring women from overtime work, benefited men because they weren't competing with women for overtime work, and the women who were seeking overtime work at odd hours were the women who were trying, who were poor women who were trying to raise children and needed to be able to work overnight shifts in order to be home for children during the day. And yet this quote-unquote protection was actually injurious. And we're arguing is that by claiming that we're going to protect females from getting injured, that's just part of a long line of thinking, faulty thinking, that has really injured women and kept women from equal access and opportunity.
That's correct. And from a legal perspective, courts have actually said that coercively segregating women so they are not allowed to even have the option of playing with boys itself is the injury. That stigmatizes the subordinate group, that coercive segregation itself creates an injury. It doesn't protect women from injury. It is the cause of injury. And so from a legal perspective, that idea that protection is another word for not only discrimination but harmful discrimination is backed up.
We have about 10 minutes left. I have a number of other callers, and I just wanted to get on here to some other folks, and perhaps also I should introduce the guests once more for anyone who might have tuned in. Eileen McDonough is professor of political science at Northeastern University. Laura Papanos, journalist. She's currently a writer in residence at the Wellesley Centers for Women at Wellesley College. They are the co-authors of the book Playing with the Boys, Why Separate is Not Equal in Sports, published by the Oxford University Press. And it goes into this subject in great depth, much more than we will be able to do here on this program. So if you're interested in thinking about this some more and reading about it, you should look at that book. Several callers here ready to go. In fact, the lines are full, and folks, again, will help us by trying to be brief. That way we can get in as many as we can. The next is in Charleston, and line number 4.
Hello.
Yes.
That was an excellent segue to my question, what you were just talking about sort of institutionalized discrimination. What I find almost as pernicious or maybe worse is just sort of the more subtle everyday forms. Like, I have a degree in women's studies from University of Tennessee a long time ago, and I guess I thought this whole discussion of separate spheres and stuff was sort of not as common, but the other day, my four-year-old daughter and I were looking at a toy catalog, and it just hit me. She looked at a picture of a boy kicking a soccer ball into a net, and she said, "Girls can't play soccer, Mom." And I was just floored. And I said, "Well, why do you say that?" And she said, "Because, look, there's no girls."
Uh-huh.
And I realized there's these images everywhere. So if you don't visually or verbally include, you know, the other half of the planet in your everyday life, then they're not going to automatically include themselves. So I guess I'm going to be schlepping our family to some soccer games this season so she could actually see girls play. And I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Okay.
Well, you're absolutely right, and that's a wonderful idea, is to expose. I mean, girls and females need to own sports as much as boys do, because it's almost a birthright. And I think one of the things that you point out is that there is this subtle message that females get about their place in sports. And I'll give you two examples. One is that if we look at ticket prices, and you mentioned University of Tennessee, well, the Lady Vols are a championship team and have been under Pat Summitt for years, and yet the season ticket prices for watching her team play is, you know, is around half of what it is for the men's team. Now, last night went on and looked at the University of Illinois women's and men's basketball season ticket prices, and I saw that the men's season ticket in the, I guess, Tier A is $554, whereas the women's season tickets are $90. And for student tickets, it's $11 to see the guys, and it's free to see the female players. And both of them last year finished fourth in the Big Ten. I think that, you know, things like that send very quiet messages and not so quiet messages. And I mean, for example, you know, even in non-revenue producing sports, nice thing about the University of Illinois is that they charge the same for seeing men's and women's soccer. But at Rutgers, for example, it costs $4 to see the women's soccer team play and $7 to see the men's soccer team play. And all of these things do conspire to have an effect. And what you observed with your daughter, I observed in a different way with my daughter last spring watching my son play Little League. My daughter, who's a very good athlete, was watching the team play and watching some of the boys be, you know, super players and some of them, you know, swinging their jackets around in outfield. And she turned to me and she said, I could have played Little League. There is this quiet sense that even very competent athletic girls get that somehow, by birthright, the boys will be better.
Well, let's talk again with another caller here in St. Joe. This is line one. Hello.
Yes, I was wondering if you noted the hostility that some people will have towards Title IX, talking about the fact that their sports are being cut or unable to continue, like wrestling at a collegiate level, and they'll say the reason their program had to be dropped was because of Title IX. You know, now because they have to include women's sports, some of the smaller men's sports are being cut, but rather than saying that the colleges just aren't going to fund the sports like they should, they'll say it's because now women have to have sports that now we can't do what we need to.
Well, I think one thing is to keep in mind is that this is partly a result of this pernicious idea that there are men's sports to start with versus women's sports. Wrestling, for example, is an interesting sport because it happens to be a sport that actually women's group difference makes women actually more suited for wrestling than men, because women have a lower center of gravity, and what you really need in wrestling is a stance that keeps you firm so you don't get knocked over, because then that is really a major part of the sport. And if you control for weight, women can do very well in wrestling and have been doing better. Instead of cutting the wrestling team for men, why not make it co-ed and only tolerate a woman who wants to play, be on the wrestling team, but encourage women to be on the wrestling team? And then you would not only keep the wrestling team for men, but you'd also have a way of bringing more women into sports. So I think the problem that you identify is endemic to this whole idea or way that Title IX was implemented, which was to reinforce this concept of men's teams, women's teams to begin with.
And the argument that it's the women that are leading to the cutting of the men's wrestling team is just, you know, it's just not accurate. I mean, the truth of the matter is that at all but 15 Division One, 15 of the 326 Division One colleges, the entire budget for women's sports is less than, at only 15 does it equal the budget for the men's football team. So the idea that that it's the women's sports that are causing the problem is not true. It's football.
And also, let's be very careful about distinguishing between football as revenue-producing versus football as profit-producing. The football budgets eat up so much money that even if they do produce revenue, it's not as likely they're going to produce profit. So that the argument that somehow it's justified to keep these teams because they produce revenue without looking at how much they cost to begin with is a really skewed way to argue that, for their value.
Right. It's only a handful of football teams in the country that actually make money, and you know, we all know about them, the ones who are in the, you know, BC Championship Series, and they make a lot of money, but you know, most football programs, you know, cost far more money than they bring in.
Yeah. All right, let's go to another caller here. This is Champagne in line 2. Hello.
I'm a bit off topic. Am I there?
Yes.
Okay, I'm a bit off topic, so I'll be brief. My son-in-law was British. He went to Harrow, and he was on the wrestling team.
Mm-hmm.
The strange thing is that because he was so puny, he was always the other teams, Eton and all those, they were afraid to wrestle him. So every time there was a tournament, he always won because the other team conceded.
Mm-hmm.
And he went through school and was the champion wrestler of his school for the whole time he was there, only because nobody wrestled him.
Mm-hmm.
He never once wrestled.
Uh-huh.
And I just thought it was funny.
It is. But, I mean, I think the point about other people conceding, I mean, one of the problems that some female wrestlers have had is that other teams have taken stances where they refuse to wrestle a female. Now, certainly, that I think that's happening less, but than even just 4 or 5 years ago. But it has definitely been an issue.
Do you think at heart that, I mean, we talked earlier about the fact that there were some boys who would be emotionally devastated being beaten by a girl. But does it have something to do with just this idea that it involves grabbing the other person, and that it's somehow boys and girls grabbing each other like that? That we think that there's something that's problematic about that?
Certainly that's been the kind of verbal argument, but certainly that's not nobody worries about a male gynecologist grabbing the female patient. So I think, you know, it's kind of misplaced. When you're competing athletically, your brain is not in that kind of place.
Right. And also let's be aware of the fact that, you know, we don't want to take for granted that only heterosexual issues are relevant to sports. Teenagers or any students that of any age that are not heterosexually oriented, you could make the same argument for same sex, that there's a problem with same sex wrestling. So that the idea that there's some sexual issue involved in competition between students would go beyond just boys playing or wrestling with girls. It would involve boys wrestling with boys, assuming that we expand our view of sexuality to include sexual issues that might be related to same-sex wrestlers. Mm.
We got one more caller here. This is Urbana Line 3. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'd like to thank you for your program today. It's been very enlightening. I have one comment and question regarding the treatment of women's sports in the media, and unfortunately this affects WILL-AM as well in the reporting of local scores for women. It's always the men's basketball team that gets reported first. It's usually men's Big Ten before even Illinois women's Big Ten. So, and it's not just a WILL problem, obviously. All national media have very little reporting of women's athletics. If you looked at the New York Times last weekend, last Sunday's sports section, 12 pages and maybe half a page that covered women's sports, and I would just would like to hear your comments on that. And again, thank you for your work and for the show.
Okay.
I think what you point out is absolutely true. And I mean, I can tell you, I've watched golf. I've watched, you know, major women's golf tournaments on television, only to have them cut off before the, you know, last hole because they had to go to the men's coverage. I mean, it is a you know, there is more coverage of women's sports than there was in the past, but it is a major, major problem. And I think one of the things that needs to change is, I think we need a little grassroots here, is that women have not. I think this has changed, but women have to more and more be perceived as, and be, not just be perceived, but actually be sports fans, be sports, you know, consumers. And that absolutely is changing, but we need more women callers to sports radio. We need to have a presence because, you know, sports is not just about entertainment. It's not just about stuff the guys do. Sports is a major vehicle for it's a major political tool for empowerment, and women have to own it and embrace it.
Right. Agreed.
And do you think, just I'm just pretty much up against the end here, but that within another perhaps generation, this is going to change, that we will have more boys and girls playing on mixed teams?
We hope so.
I was going to say, we hope so. I think our goal has been to identify a problem and bring attention to it, and that is always the first step, and there has to be more after that, and so we will definitely be looking for ways to implement policies and views that that sort of embrace this idea that gender should not be the first criterion when deciding how to organize sports.
Yeah.
And I think women have to look beyond Title IX. I mean, I think the problem is that it's been kind of heresy to challenge Title IX. If you're a female, if you're a feminist, if you care about, you know, sports, it's been something that, you know, no one dared to criticize. And I think we've, you know, reached a moment where, you know, it is time to, you know, value what it contributed, but it's time to raise our voices.
Well,
right.
There we will have to stop. And again, I want to say to people, this issue, our guests, Eileen McDonough and Laura Papineau, have gone into this in much greater detail and depth in their book, which is Playing with the Boys, Why Separate is Not Equal in Sports, published by the Oxford University Press. So if you'd like to read more and look for the book. Professor McDonough, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Laura Papineau, thank you.
Thank you.